call the Wednesday, June 30th edition of the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. Okay, I gave our staff to order. We make this a subcommittee because I've been called to a leadership meeting. I'm going to turn this public hearing over to the able chairmanship of Senator Hannon. And I see we're picking up members as we come, so that's good. We probably won't be getting to a work session today, and I appreciate everyone coming. I will get back here as soon as I possibly can. I don't know if it's a five-minute meeting or a five-hour meeting. So without further ado, I will surrender, relinquish, and provide the gavel to him.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, we'll have a public hearing and no work session on HGR 82 relating to inmate labor. Public hearing, Department of Corrections, Linda Hahn and Michael Taffy. Chief, I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee.
And, Chair, if I could make a couple comments at the beginning.
Yes, I'm sorry, Larry. I should have asked.
This HGR 82 is a proposal to amend the Oregon Constitution and eliminate the regulation of the inmate work program by the Prison Industries Board and shift that regulation through the Director of the Department of Corrections. I have placed before you the staff meeting summary for the committee that it came out of, the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law. I have also placed before you the dash B4 amendment and also the fiscal impact statement. And in brief, the B4 amendments basically cover the contingency of there not being a special election in accordance with House Bill 2354 and provides another opportunity for this matter to come before the people for a vote at the next special election. For purposes of the co-chair's budget, this was scheduled here. The fiscal impact reflects what the total impact would be if this bill were on the ballot by itself. As you know, there are numerous measures that are going to be referred for the voters. We do not plan to amend this bill to add an appropriation. That appropriation for Secretary of State will either be provided in that bill, House Bill 2354, or the Secretary of State will then do by normal process come back to the E-board where it gets funded for those kinds of activities. So for fiscal purposes, I'm not aware of any reason to amend the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Ben DeHaan, welcome.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. With me today at the table is Michael Tate. Michael is responsible for the inmate work programs at the Department of Corrections. We are here, obviously, in support of House Joint Resolution 82 being engrossed, and that now would include the amendments, the B4 amendments. This, I've given you written testimony, probably the most efficient way of handling this for me to highlight the individual changes to the Constitution and then probably respond to any of your questions. I think first I'd like to say that obviously a change of this magnitude requires some tweaking as we go through and we learn what it's like to implement Measure 17, and we view these changes as sort of fine-tuning in order to help us move along towards full compliance. The biggest thing that is accomplished, there are five very important issues for us. The first one really is a restatement of the importance of allowing inmate work to benefit the community. That has been subject to some controversy. The Constitution talks about making a profit for the private sector, but we are in support of the language explicitly directing us to use inmate labor in support of good works in the community. Another change in the Constitution, we expressly allow the Department of Corrections director to delegate responsibility. There has been some legal concern about his ability to do that to further the industry's programs, and the language will clarify that. Third change requires inmate work programs income generated to be kept in separate accounts. That is a separation of income or other funds from general fund. Fourth change, one of the larger changes, would eliminate the Prison Industries Board. And it is our belief that in setting up another form of governance, delegating responsibility to the director and his designees, that we can more efficiently engage in private partnerships, and that's been a problem for us as far as retaining interest in the private sector. And lastly, what this bill will do is it gives us clarifying language about competition in the private sector. As the Constitution now permits competition, and these changes would allow greater definition about when to avoid competition, and expressly directs the department to be careful about displacing jobs, displacing workers in fields where people would lose their jobs. So that very, very quickly, in a nutshell, are the changes, and again, the department is in support of all of them.
Could I ask, in your definition here, it says regulate competition with the private sector. If your first charge is allow inmate work programs to benefit the community, at what point does it benefit the community at the expense of someone in the community?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a very difficult call to make. The way that it's been handled to date is that we've tried to be sensitive in starting businesses that would compete. Again, the Constitution allows us to, but it's been a judgment on the part of the department. For example, if we're repackaging goods and we'd be competing with disabled workers, that's a very poor policy choice. It's something that we would refrain from. And in this language, what it says is that we won't displace workers, but there's a certain amount of common sense that's still required here. And I think most people would agree that we shouldn't use an incarcerated workforce to put on citizens out of work. And that's something the department does not intend to do.
My other question is, what has not been done by the Prison Industries Board that would require this to be abolished and move the effort over to the director's office? Has the Prison Industries Board failed to act in a certain manner, or have they not achieved something that causes this change in the outcome of violence?
Senator Hannon, I would not characterize it as a situation where people have failed to discharge their responsibilities. I think the way I would state it is that this is a very complicated deal. There are lots of stakeholders. Having the three highest constitutional officers in our state making individual decisions about whether or not we should expand the laundry is probably not a good use of their time. It's very difficult to get the board together, and it's just something that we think that we could handle more efficiently internally, because after all, we run a pretty large operation as it is, and we feel that both responsibilities should be delegated.
Well, Ben, I'll be real honest with you. I was chairman who created the Prison Industries Board, and maybe it's the fault of being here too long, but it worked fine for a number of years, and I'm still looking for what is happening that is not being carried out, that we need to change this. We could make the same argument that the three constitutional officers should not be on the land board either, because there's insignificant decisions on whether somebody has a boat dock on their property or not. So we could also make that same argument that the three constitutional officers have more pressing business at hand rather than working with a constituent on a boat dock in their backyard.
Senator Hannon, I'm sure you could make that argument.
It's a two-way street.
That may be the case.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Representative Maddox.
If I may, I'm probably in a freer position to comment on your inquiry since I was the sponsor of Measure 17. Earlier, Prison Industries Board, which was a statutory board, which I call it something of an advisory board, was eliminated, and this Prison Industries Board was established in the Constitution with three constitutional officers, and the idea was that they would expedite prison work programs, that they would serve as a common sense board that could oversee the programs, and at the same time exercise discretion to make sure that for instance, prison work programs did not displace jobs in the private sector. But what's happened is there's a number of opinions from the Attorney General which have severely limited the range of discretion of the Director of Corrections and require that the Director of Corrections go to the Prison Industries Board for many more decisions than any of us ever anticipated about how to implement prison work, so that it did become, in terms of the time availability of these elected constitutional officers, it became something of an obstacle to get things done because they just couldn't be meeting every week to be approving all of these, making all of these decisions. And as an example of the kinds of issues that we still have to deal with from the Attorney General's interpretation, this bill also makes it clear that the director can actually delegate some of his duties to others. You would think that that would be implicit in any director's job. I certainly thought so, but we've heard otherwise from the Attorney General's office, and somehow you get the image that under the current constitutional provision, you have a Prison Industries Board, and then apparently the Director of Corrections is supposed to be micromanaging his own staff every day. I happen to personally think that that's a ludicrous interpretation, but in light of those kinds of interpretations, we've had to take another look at this and see whether or not it's better to simply say, all right, the Director of Corrections is in charge of prison industries, the governor as an elected official is responsible for appointing that person, then the one elected official who will be in the hot seat, so to speak, will be the governor. And again, I want to compliment the Secretary of State and the Treasurer for the work they've tried to do, but they've been bound by these legal opinions. And if you think of Gulliver being tied down by all those ropes and Gulliver's Travels, I think of the Prison Industries Board members being tied down by a variety of legal ropes, and we've decided to try to cut those legal ropes with this proposal.
The only question I would have, and I'm not sure Ben DeHaan is the person asked or new representative, but if we abolish this three constitutional officers and take it out of the Constitution, put it back in the Department of Corrections, is there just going to be another Prison Industries Board recreated somewhere that will oversee this? And if it is, what assurances do we have? Maybe of
Senator, in fact, under the original setup, and as in the private constitutional provision, the Director of Corrections is supposed to run prison industry, but then the policymakers are supposed to be the prison industry's board. The interpretation has been to grant the prison industry's board much more than what I would think of as policy power, as management power, so the director's been there having to run back to this board for management authority, and that ties things down. Under this revised version, the Director of Corrections is definitely the person in charge, and if there is any prison industry board established by statute, they would have to be an advisory board, because under the Constitution, the director will be in charge, and you'll probably go back to a model from the past where you did have an advisory board, and that can be created by statute, but they cannot take over the program. They can advise the director, and the governor and the director will be the people responsible for the program.
The only last thing, and I know I'm eating up time there, I don't want to do that, but you represented myself, were appointed as ex-official members to a prison board task force that looked at this issue. And a lot of the recommendations came out in the form of ballot measure 17, I believe, from that task force that you and I served on. Is this now to admit that perhaps not everything was considered appropriately at the time, and now it's time to change it?
Senator, I'd say that some things change because, I'm trying to be diplomatic the way I put this, but given the times and given the people involved, things might have been different if other people had been involved in this process. But we are now at a stage where, given a certain number of legal opinions, we need to take a step back and move in a slightly different direction.
And I'm not being critical of you for doing that. I'm just recalling that we served together, and it was an issue that you and I had both deep feelings on about prison industries.
If I may, Senator, it's probably just an acknowledgement that not all things are perfect, and sometimes modifications are necessary.
Okay.
The only clarification I'd make relative to the next comment is that in the companion bill, Hospital 2048, it does establish under the director an advisory council, a three-person advisory council, which in effect is like an administrative policy advice body that replaces the prison industry board.
Okay.
And I might add there, even in that model, in 2048, which we'll talk about shortly, the department director remains in control of the process in both models. What exists today is a fully integrated division in the Department of Corrections, and what will exist if 2488 passes.
Okay.
Any other questions that I can answer?
Larry, do you have a question?
On behalf of Representative Wesley, he asked me to ask a couple questions related to the bill. The language, he was curious about the language being added that talks about benefiting the community and supporting community charitable organizations. He wanted to know what the department would do differently based on the addition of that language that it hasn't done.
Can I help with that, since I'm the one who brought up that language? If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
There have been arguments made that prison work programs can only be used in a limited way to benefit government or to make money. And that because it doesn't say that you can help charitable organizations or to benefit the private sector, the community, that sending out a prison work crew, for example, to assist with some community project actually is not authorized by the Constitution. I personally feel that those arguments are bogus, but since we have an opportunity to revisit the issue, and I've heard that such arguments are being made in some communities, I would rather see it be made explicitly clear that we have no problem if, say, United Way is running a program and the Department of Corrections has got a prison work crew available and they're running a festival, and they need some help erecting some stuff at the festival, and there's a prison work crew that just finished doing some parks work, and they've got a couple extra hours. It's okay for them to go over and help set up the tents or whatever, that they're not violating the law. And I've heard some arguments in Eastern Oregon when I was visiting it out there that the prison work crews couldn't be used in such activities. And I heard this from corrections officials, and it was not the people that were benefiting from it for arguing. It was other people saying, well, we're not so sure you can do this. It amazed me that anybody would suggest that, but... And I wouldn't, by the way, suggest that we amend the Constitution just for that reason. But since we are, the way the format is for legislative councils, we always put the whole piece back on the ballot. I thought, okay, let's make it clear that we're going to help the Boys and Girls Club and the United Way and any other charitable group if it fits in with the prison work program.
Other questions?
Just one other one. And then he just wanted to know for the record whether there was any known opposition to the resolution.
None that I'm aware of. There were some initial concerns expressed by various labor organizations, and we had discussions with them, and some of them are here today, so I'm unaware of any opposition at this point.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, both of you. Governor's Office and Department of Transit Services, Steve Marks and Bill McGee.
Sir, and I put them on the agenda and on the chance that they may have something they want to speak to in the bill.
Okay.
Or more if there were specific questions for that.
All right.
He's not here.
All right. Susan Towns. If you'd like to come forward, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Suzanne Townsend, Deputy Secretary of State. I'm here at the committee's request on behalf of Secretary Kiesling to answer any questions that you might have about the Secretary's position, and also to talk just a little bit about several minor concerns with the companion legislation, HB 2488, if that's appropriate at this point.
Yes, if I should have said that earlier, if you just identify which measure you want to discuss, we're having an open hearing on both issues. So So if there's something in the bill rather than the ballot measure, we would certainly entertain your comments.
Thank you. With respect to the House Senate Resolution 82, Secretary Houston does not oppose that part of the bill that would eliminate the Prison Industry Board. We have understood from the Department of Corrections almost from the beginning that having the Prison Industry Board as the final oversight has been very unwieldy for them and has made it more difficult for them to do their work. And on that basis, not in opposition. With respect to how the program is configured after the Prison Industry Board is eliminated, he's leaving that decision and discussion and policy to those who would have continuing oversight, which would be, of course, the legislature, the governor, and the department, the director of the Department of Corrections. So we haven't been involved in any of the discussions on how it would be configured after the board is eliminated. But the Secretary will have several interactions with the newly created Corrections Enterprises even after the board is eliminated with respect to his role as the constitutional auditor of public accounts and also through the Archives Division in his also constitutional role and mandate to keep an accurate record of the acts of the Executive Department. And as we understand the companion legislation that creates the Corrections Enterprises, they will still be a state agency, and they will still, the funds that they have will still be public accounts and they're subject to audit, and their records will be public records in the sense that they will be part of the Executive Department. And so we'll need to have access and the ability to make sure that those records are retained for the appropriate period, either for some amount of years or in some instances, records are retained permanently. And those are the Secretary's constitutional duties, so we're interested in making sure that it's clear that he still has the ability to do that. And I suggested some amendments to House Bill 2488, which I think you have a copy of. And as I understand from Mr. DeHaan, there's no objection from corrections to these. One would eliminate the part of the bill that exempts the Corrections Enterprises from the archive statutes, which are ORS 357-805 to 357-895, and also ORS 192-105. And this, again, just to clarify, deals with records retention, not public records access. And we don't have any position on that. What they're asking for is some ability, as I understand it, to have some records that are related to their business matters not be subject to public access. This is a different part of the public records issue, the retention, just to make sure that those documents that are at the core of government and need to be retained for government purposes, that those are still retained. So that's the issue with respect to archives and the public records. And then with respect to audits, we wanted to clarify who was responsible to pay for the cost of the audits of Oregon Corrections Enterprises. We found that in looking through the bill that it was somewhat difficult to exactly understand the relationship that's going to be there with respect to DOC and the director in Oregon Corrections Enterprises. So we're suggesting an amendment that makes it clear that the cost of audits of Oregon Correction Enterprises would be paid by the Corrections Enterprises. And those are our two suggestions.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions? Larry?
Just to the, again, I really didn't have breath, but I wanted to be sure and get on the record. It was his understanding that whenever an entity changes from a public to a semi-private or a directorship change, that the Secretary of State has an audit rule. Would that rule be carried out in this case when the bill takes effect?
Can I ask you to speak up because people in the back can't hear you?
Okay.
I see them straining to hear what you're saying.
Could you speak to the change of director audit responsibilities and whether those would be carried out?
Yes, Senator Hannah members of the committee. The audit division routinely performs an audit when the director of an agency changes or when something happens to the agency where it either goes out of business or there is a change like this. And that's something that I don't think there's any statutory provision that specifically requires that, but it's something that we've routinely done in order to make sure that there is a good transition. Okay. John Larimer just corrected me. There is a statutory requirement, so that we would do it, I think, even if there weren't, but there is a statutory requirement for a change of director audit, and we would be doing that. And I think John would be happy to answer questions about what that might entail, if that's of interest. And, of course, that would be something we would do, I'm assuming, after we know whether or not the people have adopted the resolution.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other additional questions? No, thank you very much, Ms. Harrison. John Latimer, did you want to make any comments?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Latimer, Director of the Audit Division. This is a very low chair, and I'm a very short person. So.
And this is a short committee.
I have no comments, Senator. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions by committee members or staff? Do you want to ask Mr. Latimer any questions?
The only thing that I was aware of was, is there any concerns around the audit trail that will be left for the agency to leave records for you? And those are addressed to the addressed to the archives amendment that Suzanne spoke to?
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think we have any concerns about that. In past audits that we've done of prison industries, we've found problems with record keeping, so it makes it difficult to audit. But under this legislation and under the resolution, we can audit. It's going to be the adequacy of the record keeping, whether the audit is fruitful or not.
Perfect in a minute.
House Bill 2048 as amended, if we adopted your recommended amendment. Are you comfortable with that?
Mr. Chair, in minutes, yes, we are. The only concern we have, because of the change this session in the way we are funded, we were concerned because this would be a semi-independent agency, that it be clear that whereas we were unsure, we're assuming that this is an independent agency independent of the Department of Corrections, so we needed to have a way to pay for the audit of this organization. And so we just wanted it clear in the statutes that the payment was there. We weren't really concerned because the Attorney General said that the constitutional authority is there to do the audit.
Thank you.
The only other question I have is, we heard statements made earlier. I'm not sure if it was a good representative from Salem or someone who said that, maybe it's Mr. DeHaan, said that the three state constitutional officers are busy and it hasn't worked. Have you proven this in the audit of this agency to say, yes, it doesn't work and yes, it should be changed? Or is this something we're trying to do without really recognizing what the full impact may or may not be?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have not performed an audit of the Prison Industries Board itself or its
operation. So there's really no roadmap that says this needs to be changed and here's the reason why.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that I would rely on the good offices of the constitutional officers and their opinion on that matter because we haven't audited it.
Thank you. Further questions of these individuals? If not, Raleigh Weisbrock, Treasurer.
Mr. Chair, we have really no comments on your questions. We're fine with the minutes, and I think the dash can as we present.
If you come up for a moment, How much of the treasurer's time is spent in making policy decisions relating to the prison industries?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisper, Chief of Staff of the Treasury. We meet on a quarterly basis, usually, and there's a six-month, I think, requirement for a meeting, and usually those meetings take about an hour. The issue for the Treasury, and I think for the Secretary of State, is not the amount of time that it takes, and I think people are dancing perhaps around the issue. There's an Attorney General's opinion that requires the three constitutional officers to opine on every contract and judgment that is made relevant to the Prison Industries Board. And we do so without staff. Let me explain what that would look like. If we would have a prison workforce that would do tree planting, for example, and they had to buy toilet paper for the, and this is an example that we shared with, I asked this question with the Attorney General. We had to buy toilet paper to supply the inmates. That board, the Prison Industries Board, would have to approve the sale, the purchase of that toilet paper. That's how detailed it is. Now, if the Secretary of State, the Governor, and the Treasurer of the State of Oregon have to opine on those individual contracts as oversight, then they need the staff, they would need the staff, to do the independent work so they can opine on those contracts, as opposed to having the Department of Corrections, and no discredit to the Department of Corrections, they do a good job. When they bring that contract to the three constitutional officers, they say, you know, you have to review and opine that this contract is adequate and approve it. And that is really a problem. You are looking at the staff of the Prison Industries Board. And I spend, you know, a great deal of time, and I know my counterparts in the Governor's office and the Secretary of State's office spend a great deal of time, you know, working on these issues. And I am not the expert on this. We do not have the staff in the Treasury that is dedicated to review corrections contracts, particularly toilet paper contracts. And that's just that's the level of silliness that it has gotten to. We also think, just as a policy level, that the governor is in charge of corrections, should be responsible for that conduit of a chain of command, if you will, through the Department of Corrections that has the oversight of the legislature and the appointment of that bot, so that the director of corrections bumbled that out. But the legislature still has oversight, and the governor has oversight, and putting the three constitutional officers in that mix with the detail that is required of them as per the Attorney General really is the problem. It's not the amount of time that the treasurer or the secretary or the governor would have to spend on them individually. It's what they're signing off on would require a huge amount of time of the staff and basically duplicates the staff of the corrections department. Those are our issues.
Questions? Yes, sir.
Just a couple things of clarification. You were involved in the drafting of the amendments, and you mentioned that you're okay with those amendments before the committee, the dash 10 amendments.
Mr. Chair and committee, we're comfortable with the dash 10. We have no problem with them.
One of the early concerns when it came out in gross form, as I understand it, was the ability of the department to enter into credit enhancing agreements to go on to incur debt. Could you speak briefly to what the agreement was and what their ability to incur debt is now? And then also speak to a little bit to the process by which they are taking their funds are taken out of the Treasury and put into a private account. I think those were two things that you had some input on.
Mr. Chair, in committee, our concern was primarily that, as constituted with the change, that the semi-independent body would have the authority to use the credit in the name of the State of Oregon and issue debt independent of the approval of DAF, the legislature, or the Treasury, and that is a major concern. The credit of the State of Oregon is a valuable commodity, and a number of years ago in the early 80s, and Senator Hannon, I believe you were here, a change was made to have a centralized debt issuance process, and that debt issuance process involves the Department of Administrative Services and the Treasury managing the authorized debt authorized by the state legislature. The way it was constituted in 2488 would have allowed that semi-independent body to issue debt under the name of the State of Oregon without that oversight. And we felt that it's a very poor policy, and that was our primary concern. The accounts, you know, are manageable. We can have accounts for semi-independent agencies as long as they follow the proper ORS and, you know, the accounting principles, and that's covered, as I understand, within the context of the bill, so we're comfortable.
So the method by which they can incur debt now, could you explain that a little bit? Under the amendment.
Under the amendment, they would be able to incur debt the way any agency under the state of Oregon can incur debt. They would go through the bond bill, basically would get us authorization through the state legislature, and could incur debt in that way.
I believe does the Debt Bond Advisory Committee have oversight on the issuance of the bonds?
Mr. Chair, no. The Treasury itself would be, but the State Debt Policy Commission that you're referring to would review the amount of money that would be indebted by the semi-independent agency and inform the legislature what impact that has on our total capacity for debt issuance.
Okay.
That would be their role. But the Treasurer and DAS would look specifically, as we will with every agency, whether the debt is responsible and is being managed in a responsible way. It's just making sure. But I believe that they would also have authority and I'm getting into corrections, I think, territory, and maybe Michael or Ben would be best, you know, suited to answer this question, but I think they would have authority to do letters of credit under the supervision of the Department of Administrative Services and Corrections, which is how most private companies would engage in the market. And I think one of the concerns that the semi-independent agency had is being able to be competitive within the market to fund, and we are very sensitive to that. But it can't be done without the proper oversight. So I think the amendments have taken the authority to independently issue debt, but we still think they have the capacity to do other means, engage other means.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify?
One other name here.
Vernon White, would you like to testify, please?
Also, while he's coming up, I might clarify. I think the department has a presentation to make eventually on House Bill 2488 a little bit to talk about the nature of the amendments. Is that correct, Ben? Okay.
Okay. Let's let Mr. White testify first. No, that's fine.
Senator Hannon and members of the committee, I'm Vernon White. For the session, I am the budget and tax analyst for the speaker, Vince Snodgrass, but I'm here on behalf of a long former life. I was for 13 years the editor of Western Timber Industry, which is a lumber and woods publication, and I want to be sure, and I don't see in here very specifically, the authorization for camps to be set up in our forested areas for work to be done there which is not done at all or is done too infrequently. So the particular work I have in mind is not in any way competitive with other people. Specifically, Douglas fir comes up and immediately attracts weeds. It dies or is stultified if it doesn't get clear sunlight. It costs a lot of money, of course, to have people come in and clear it, but that could and should be done in behalf of not using herbicides. More importantly, in the deep woods, a Douglas fir, typically, when the limb dies for lack of sunlight because the tree and the forest around it have grown up beyond it, it sits there for about 65 years before it actually falls off from lack of life. The result is that as the tree grows, that limb forms a situation in the tree which continues until it is gone, and that prevents the tree from putting on a knot. That prevents the tree from putting on clear wood. Clear wood is much more valuable for ladder stock, for rafters, for plank, for ship decking, and other uses. And Oregon Douglas fir is probably weight to strength the best timber in the world, and we do export to our great advantage a great deal of this to Australia and other consuming countries. Financial authorities in any large corporation certainly are not going to approve the use of labor now to cut those limbs off so that the clear wood can be put on, because the time at which they will gain the harvest of the clear wood is 65 or whatever, a very large number of years away. But if prison labor were used, it seems to me that in the very long run, we would be advantaged, our successors at least, in the lives of the state of Oregon. And I have a difficult time seeing how it would be impossible to take prisoners who are nonviolent and are in trustee status and putting some sort of a device on them to make sure you knew where they were. If you can trace a wolf from central Idaho into eastern Oregon with a belt, you certainly could understand where these people were. We have an enormous advantage in the state of Oregon in that we own forests of our own, the state itself, and we manage many others, the Tillamook Burn and so forth. So that would be a direct advantage to the state itself if we were to do this. It also, of course, could be farmed out to private corporations. And I'm sorry, I'm not quite convinced from what I see in the bill that authorization to do that is there. I would urge that it should be there.
Okay. This is Jahan. Would you come back up for a moment? Would you like to respond to the questions that's been raised here by the speaker's representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Benjamin Zihan, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I guess the short answer to your concerns is that, yes, we agree. It's the kind of work that we like to see inmates doing. In fact, as we speak, there are 80 inmates now up in the Deschutes National Forest outside of Sam doing work that, while not absolutely identical to what you described, is very closely related to it, abatement of noxious weeds and so forth. As far as authorization goes, we do have authorization to use inmate labor in that way now. And in the bill that we proposed, 2488, on page 11, there's a section 3, it's line 25, that authorizes the use of inmate labor for cultivating, clearing, grading, draining, and repairing riparian, that's hard to say, riparian areas. So just to summarize, we agree that that's a benefit. It's the kind of work we'd like inmates to do, and we do have the authority now, and it's maintained in our bill as well.
Okay. I guess I was set off by the use of the word riparian, which means stream side, and of course a lot of this work would not be that close to trains. But
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. Keith Cutler, Department of Justice. Welcome to the committee.
Jimmy, I asked Keith to come today as a Department of Justice representative. He worked on some of the amendments to the bill before us, and if you could just speak to whether or not they addressed the concerns that you had in his engrossed version.
Sure. For the record, my name is Keith Cutler. Last name is spelled with a K as well.
Sorry about that.
Quite all right. As you noted, I've worked with the Department of Corrections and Development of House Bill 2488. It's been an interesting process. As I say, we've worked with them throughout it. We're comfortable with the bill as it now stands. We're comfortable with the amendments that have been proposed by the Secretary of State today. One never knows what we might learn in the future that might indicate we've overseen something today. We're in the business of trying to facilitate what state agencies want to do. We've worked with the Department of Corrections on this bill to do that. and I think it's a good bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. Mr. Cutler, could you please enlighten me as to what in these amendments represents the Department of Justice's input? Can you walk me through? I'm not familiar with the role that you played, so if you could be more specific, it would help me.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. I need to speak a little more generally than you've been going through the amendments line by line or word by word. You know, as you know, we represent state agencies. The Department of Corrections came to us with a proposed bill. We talked to them about some what we viewed as some virtues in that proposed bill and what we viewed as some problems. We talked about that with the department, with Mr. Gahan, Mr. Tate, and others.
What was the problem?
Well, the original bill that came to us was in a very different form than the bill that's coming today. The original bill very much followed the model of the Oregon Health Sciences University. There were a number of problems we identified. Included among them, I would say the principal ones, were a couple of constitutional problems. One of the problems was that the bill would have provided for stock ownership by corrections enterprises, and that's contrary to another constitutional provision. It would have probably required a separate constitutional amendment in order to accomplish that change. Another potential problem, or another very real problem, and a very significant one, was that that original bill would have delegated authority in a way that was inconsistent with what the constitutional provision would have been. And that inconsistency could have been fatal when the proposed constitutional provision at that time and the proposed the initial proposed House Bill 2488.
Could you, if I may, what authority and what inconsistency are you referring to? I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, Mr. Chair Gordley, the section Article 1, Section 41 of the Constitution imposes certain duties on the director. The original House Bill 2488 imposed duties on a new corporation, and the line of authority going from the director to that new corporation was not clear. In addition, there would have been real questions about the authority, even if the line of delegation had been clear in statute. There was a real question about whether or not the Constitution would have authorized that kind of delegation.
Okay, and now that's the piece that I really want to understand. It's the line of authority. So if you can point me to where in the amendments that is spelled out, and you don't have them in front of
you. I have to apologize. I can run back and get them.
Senator, if I can help you just for a moment. Mr. Cutler, when we privatized and semi-quasily retained state board of directors, and we said, here is an autonomous, independent group out here, that's how the original bill started out, with the prison industry. Is that an accurate reflection? It would have been a semi-autonomous private group out here overseeing prison industry.
Mr. Chair, are you referring to how the original bill
was
drafted?
Yes, the original bill. And what this amendment does is remove all that and put it under the Department of Corrections, the director.
Let me, if I may, Mr. Chair, to redefine the amendments we're talking about just a bit. If we're talking about the A-10 amendments to the A and growth bills, we've gone way down the road from what the original was. I was starting, maybe inappropriately, maybe I didn't understand Senator Gordon's question appropriately. I was gone way back to the beginning, to an earlier version of the House bill.
And it's been amended a lot since that time.
It's been changed many times. There's only one A and growth version, however, the only one that was acted on the House side, as I understand it, and that's what comes to this committee.
But it's the A-10 amendments we're talking about.
Right. And again, Mr. Chair, the A-10s now, if we're only talking about the difference between the A-10s and the A engrossed version.
Uh-huh.
And maybe we need to start this conversation over.
Okay. Let's
start. I went back too far.
Yeah, let's start it over because I think I understand where the Senator was trying to go and what point of succession did we arrive at this.
Well, what I want to know, again, just to be clear, you said that the lines of authority are now clear. And I want to know what that is.
Okay.
So point that out to me, and that's what I'm trying to nail here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordon, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
Let me apologize once more. I don't have a copy of the H.R. 82 in its current form. I'm going to ask somebody to throw one at me right behind me. There is a provision in there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look on page 2 of Health Center Resolution 82, in subsection 7 at line 22, there's a new sentence, and it talks about the corrections, it says, and I'll read it. The corrections director may carry out the director's powers and duties under this section by delegation to others. So by inclusion of that sentence in the constitutional provision, the director will now be constitutionally authorized to delegate the authority that's granted to the director in Article 1, Section 41 to others. We then turn to the A and Growth version, Section 3. That's the section that establishes Oregon Corrections Enterprises, and it authorizes the director, I'll read again this sentence, the second sentence in that section. The director of the Department of Corrections shall assign or appoint an administrator who shall serve at the pleasure of the director. Continuing, the administrator shall have authority to do all things necessary and convenient to carry out, and then the references to House Bill 2488. So that's the clear line of authority that is established from the constitutional provision to the administrator of the new Oregon Corrections Enterprise.
Can I ask you if it still is a semi-autonomous group, though, the Oregon Prison Industries?
Mr. Chair, I have to admit that I never understand the term semi-autonomous or the term privatized.
Well, I never heard it either until I got to the legislature, and there's a lot of things that are semi-autonomous.
Yes. Mr. Chair, maybe we can talk in language that you and I can both understand. What this does is it sets up what we call, what is defined in the bill as a semi-independent agency. That tells us two things. One, it's an agency of state government. There's no question about the fact that it is an agency of the state of Oregon.
Okay.
It's also semi-independent. And we have to figure out what that means. That term isn't defined within this bill. But when you read the bill as a whole, you find out that there are certain attributes that, if passed, you will be granting to this entity that is different from most other state agencies. And
will the budget review still be a part of Ways and Means review of the corrections budget with this component inside the corrections budget?
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. Yeah. I have to admit that that understanding is subject to correction by Mr. Chase and Mr. DeHaan. But that is my understanding.
Okay.
My understanding that the limitation established in the position authority that relates specifically to the enterprise would not be included in the Department of Corrections budget review process. The only thing that I understand from the amendments that would be under the budget review would be the authority to incur debt, which would be by virtue of authority to have certificates of participation.
Mr. DeHaan, would you like to come back up, please?
I think it's important to understand that we created SAFE and says down the street and someone knows that it's all the time. And they're semi-autonomous, going back to the quote, semi-private agency that has the power of the state of Oregon behind it but doesn't have the power of legislative oversight. Is that what we're possibly creating in this?
Senator DeHaan, for the record, my name is Dan DeHaan, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I don't think so, but I'll have to explain that.
Could I, if I could go back just a couple of steps in the process, it might help in your understanding of some of the more complicated details here. We started out, we've been working on this, in the design of this agency for about, I don't know, in various forms, 4 or 5 months now, and we started with one of the models we looked at was SAVE. We rejected it after a consultation with the Department of Justice. We also looked at Oregon Health Sciences University and some other models because the overriding concern for us was that we knew that we needed to be able to form private partnerships and run this thing like a business, as much like a business as government would permit. So we started in a very extreme form, and as we amended our original bill, we put more and more controls on this semi-independent state agency. Long term, we thought about turning it into a private corporation, as some states do with these kinds of organizations. We rejected that for a number of reasons, both because of legal advice, administrative concerns from DAS and others, and also because of the relationship with our internal to DOC. So what we have here is what we think is a balance of freedom, exemption from certain administrative controls, the ability to act like a business, and controls that will be in place by DAS, by the Secretary of State, and probably most importantly by the management structure of the Department of Corrections. Because firmly, Dave Cook and the structure in our department is in control of this entity, and we are as responsible to the legislature as we are now. Now, the bill requires that we report back. There isn't a specific budgeting requirement that you would not approve the line items of that budget unless during that yearly report or what that periodic report that you would require that organization to do so. As is already stated on the record, it's a state agency, and it would be administered by Dave Cook, myself, and the other people at the Department of Corrections indirectly to a board.
Okay.
And Dave Cook this is not a perfect analogy, but if Michael Pace were the president of this company, public company, Dave would be
CEO.
He'd be the chairman of the board. So
okay. All right. Are there any other questions? No, thank you both very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on either one of these measures?
I just have one more question.
Larry?
For Keith while he's still there. One of the components of the measure requires DOJ to place attorney resources at periodically on site with Oregon Correctional Enterprises. That's a policy change in some respects because DOJ generally centrally located attorneys and then provide services, but not physically moving people on site. How do you see the department pushing that arrangement out so that the attorneys provide the service yet are available to meet other workload demands within DOJ?
Sure. Mr. Chair, again, Keith Cutler for the record. I'm not sure I view it as policy change. In fact, we do have a number of agencies where we have individual attorneys visit from time to time. To the extent this is a change, it is in the fact that it gets codified. We have discussed this issue with the department, and those discussions have led to what we envision happening under this arrangement, which, and I guess maybe I'll spend a moment and tell you why we thought this was an important arrangement for this particular enterprise. This is an enterprise that is trying to act as much like a business, as Mr. Dehan said, as any state agency can. It is an enterprise that does deals. And, you know, enterprises that do deals need attorneys at their fingertips at all stages of the deal-making process. That's a little bit different from the way most other, if not all other, state agencies operate. For that reason, we agreed in conversations with the department to provide counsel on site on some basis so that whenever they need somebody at their fingertips, there's somebody there. How exactly that's going to work will work out in the future. But our discussions have included things like We might have a couple of attorneys who are assigned to do work for the Oregon Corrections Enterprises, and we may rotate them as to when they spend time at Corrections Enterprises versus when they spend time at the Department of Justice. For example, that could work on a weekly rotation basis. It could work on a daily basis. It could work mornings, one attorney's in one place, and then they switch in the afternoon. Or it can be on an ad hoc basis as deals require. There may be times when two attorneys need to be on site. There may be times when the deal-making is low and no attorneys will need to be on site. And I presume Corrections Enterprises would not be wanting to pay for an attorney on site when the deal-making is low. We're committed to providing them the legal services they need, and we'll work out the details of exactly how that's going to work as this gets going.
Okay. Are there further questions? If not, we're adjourned until 3 p.m. tomorrow afternoon, and both these bills are carried forward. We are adjourned.